to The Jay Kim Show, Hong Kong's first dedicated podcast on investing in Asia. Join us as we survey the land and discover the greatest companies and most profitable investment opportunities in Asia. If this is your first time listening, thank you for stopping by. This podcast is produced every week with the goal of providing actionable insights to you, the listener, with every single episode. And now, on to the show.
So I'm sitting here with Clarence Ling, who is the co-founder and chief development officer of Zitor, Hong Kong's first online grocery specialist. Clarence has a very broad entrepreneurial and investing background. Apart from managing one of the largest private property development companies in Hong Kong, he's also helped dozens of overseas companies on their Asia expansion, and he's also an active investor in more than 20 startups globally, including Lalamove, which is either at or very close to becoming a unicorn. So Clarence, thank you for inviting me to your office. And I always like to do these things in person, and it's rare that I get a chance to do so. So it's a good thing that timing actually didn't work out last time, and so we were able to do it in person. So.
Nice meeting you.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe you can give a little bit of background of yourself to our audience first.
So ever since I graduated from college in the US in 2005, I came back to Hong Kong, not knowing what I wanted to do because I got rejected by all the banking jobs I applied to. 22 to be exact.
Wow.
So I started off working for Deloitte Forensic Accounting. And then went on to Bloomberg as a sales trainee, and then went to Saffold's to do property valuation. After that, I joined my family business. And then over the time, I felt that I had an urge to learn more about stuff rather than just real estate. Mm-hmm. So in 2010, I started expanding my network, especially in London. And then one day I got a call from the former foreign minister, one of the foreign ministers of UK government, asking me if I wanted to work on a deal with him. So he was the largest yacht maker in UK, which was Sunseeker. Since then I started cold emailing, cold calling, all the companies in mainland China and Asia. Since then,
what exactly was that deal? Was it
to find a buyer?
Oh, okay. Got it.
So worked on a deal, and then in 2013, I completed a deal and helped them find Wanda Group to acquire the company. It was a £320 million. Transaction. I made my first bucket of gold through that deal. Throughout that, I started also helping other companies fundraise in mainland China and also facilitating the formation of China joint venture, connecting them with the mainland Chinese companies. I was also representing few both private and state-owned enterprises in China. And in 2014, I felt that, I started to think about what's the meaning of doing this, as a broker, right?
Right.
I didn't think I was adding much value rather than, completing the transactions or being able to fundraise for them. And then there was one experience, was one time I was with my partner then. We were in London meeting with a startup, an indoor theme park startup. And then the two co-founders presented to us. And then I loved the idea. And then basically my partner said, Clarence, don't waste time on small deals because you spend the same amount of time and effort on small deals and big deals, but you make a lot more in bigger deals, right? And I didn't really agree to that. So I set up another meeting to meet with the two co-founders of that startup, specific startup, afterwards. And then we met for 2 hours and I told them, I'm very interested in investing in you guys. because then I already had money from the Sunseeker deal.
Right.
So I wanted to invest in them and then help them basically figure out the Asia expansion strategy and also fundraising strategies. And since then, I started investing in startups.
That was your foray into the startup world, right?
Yeah.
So it's pretty interesting because, you obviously have a real estate background. Your family's in real estate, a pretty prominent real estate, company here in Hong Kong. And was there some tension or when you weren't sort of diving headfirst all into the family business versus you wanting to go out and maybe make some money on your own via these deals or maybe in startup investing? Did you experience any sort of pressure within your family, or was it sort of encouraged? And this is a lot of traditional Asian parents, they have an idea of what they want their children to do, and they are very opinionated about that. My dad wanted me to be a doctor, and I ended up being a banker. So it was like the complete opposite of what he wanted. But over time, he was okay with it, right? So I'm just curious, coming from a family like yours, was there any sort of pressure, or were they very supportive of your decisions?
Well, first of all, my family has been very open-minded about it. Obviously, there are times that they complain that I don't spend enough time in the family business. But at the same time, I still remember when I first joined my family business, my dad told me never only rely on the family business. And in 2009, 2010, I started to realize our family business is a very conservative and stable business. Mm-hmm. And me back then, 20-something-year-old, I never thought, working for my family business for a few years, after working for them for a few years, I just felt that I had already learned quite a lot, in terms of real estate. Mm-hmm. And there was, because we're very highly focused on real estate, specifically Hong Kong.
Right.
I felt the urge of learning more about businesses. Mm-hmm. Right. And hence I started, working on deals as a broker.
Right.
Obviously, being a broker was no glamorous job. You take a lot of poop from your clients and everything, and then my family would feel, it's not like you're lacking money, why are you doing this,
right?
But to me, the satisfaction comes from being able to make things happen, and especially back then, I was one of the first batch of people doing cross-border transactions.
Right.
On my own. And it was kind of like one of my motives was to prove those, banks that turned me down back then.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And my satisfaction comes from connecting the dots, right, in this world. And how I can leverage my the network that I built on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And my satisfaction comes from being able to have these great businesses to be able to be seen by visionary investors.
I'll say this before we move on to the startup investing side of your story. I'll say this, you talk about brokering these deals and how it's not that glamorous, but I will say that it's extremely difficult to do. A lot of people have, even myself, I've come across these deals and they seem very easy to execute. Oh, all you have to do is just find some rich Chinese buyer and they'll take this deal, and you can make a nice cut. And to be very honest with you, Clarence, you're one of the few people that I actually know in person. You always hear about people closing these deals, but you never actually meet them. And so you're one of the few that I actually have met in person that has actually successfully executed this type of deal. When I was working in banking, I had this this desire to do this sort of thing, because the money's good if you find the other side and you can match and you get a good, nice commission. And a lot of people get lured into trying to, all we need is a couple deals, a couple of rich Chinese guys, and we're gonna be golden. But it's actually very, very, very difficult. So it's commendable what you did, and you did it sort of on your own.
Thanks.
So let's move on to your startup investing side, you know, and you kind of dove in headfirst into startup investing, as like many of us do. You know, I got enamored with startup investing right around the time when, like, it was 2010. It was right before sort of Facebook and Twitter went public, but they were very frothy. I think Tesla went public in 2010, and that was kind of very, very interesting for me. A couple years after the financial crisis, so I had some time to digest, and I was very burnt out and tired with finance. So I was like, oh, I want to look at early stage investing. You've actually been very successful on paper to now with your investments. Maybe you could spend a little bit of time just talking about what your diligence process is, investment philosophy and processes, and how you find these types of investments that you go into.
At first, in terms of investing in startups, I never knew what to do at first. I just knew, you know, as I said earlier, I really admired the passion and the vision that the two co-founders of the indoor theme park company, that how much passion they had and what their plan was, even though it was just a PowerPoint presentation. I've been pretty good at, you know, evaluating people rather than the business model.
Right.
And since then, obviously, you know, every startup investor had to pay tuition, mm-hmm. right? Going through that process, I wouldn't say I've been a very successful startup investor. You know, there obviously a few bets that I made were not that good. But I think the key for me, my investing theory, is that I like to support, you know, visionary startup founders, mm-hmm. Rather than how much I get out of it.
Right.
I think obviously startup investing, investing my personal money instead of investing on behalf of LPs, is a lot, in my point of view, is a lot easier, because I can make an investment decision based on, I would say, my emotions, my
right.
passion for the business, sure. or even every startup that I invest, I have a specific agenda behind it. Be it I want to build a closer relationship with the founder, mm-hmm. or I never really focus on the business model. I mean, for example, Lala Move, right? When I invested in 2014, you know, I could have easily just invest in Google Van, because right. back then Google Van was much was bigger.
The, yeah, yeah, right? Sure.
So basically, I searched for Xing on LinkedIn. I requested to connect and accept it. And then after that, I messaged him and said, oh, would you like to grab a coffee? And then I think the next day or 2 days later, we met up for a coffee for about 2 hours. And basically, I just said, yeah, just let me know how much allocation you have. I would really want to be involved. So it's more like I don't really put on the typical investor hat,
right.
you know, when I meet with the entrepreneurs. I only invest in companies that I think I could add value to.
Right.
You know, if there's something, be it, you know, through my network, how I would be able to connect them with, you know, useful people or useful companies. Or basically, I see that maybe it's not this company, this venture, or, you know, down the road, his next venture, or down mm-hmm. the road, I want to build a much closer relationship with the entrepreneur.
Right.
Basically, that's my theory in terms of picking the right people that I want to support, rather than focusing too much on the potential returns.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely it's you're fortunate in that you know, when you institutionalize this investing game too much, and there, right now I feel like in early stage investing there's too much money out there that needs to be deployed, and VCs are having a hard time finding companies, and you see these rounds are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and you know, you hear about SoftBank raising these ridiculous funds, and it's you know, it's a problem because you know, VC, as you're doing it yourself personally, is what I think originally what venture capital was meant to be. Now it's become so institutionalized, it's all about metrics and that return to ROI, and you have and so it not only does it take the fun out of it, it kind of warps the entire innovation, I think, of the industry. And I'm actually quite worried about this exact topic, and we could talk about it a lot, but I don't want to stay on this point for too long, but thank you for sharing that. You know, I tend to agree with your sort of your theory and your sort of investing guidelines or philosophy. You know, when I look at investing in to companies, I always look for, you know, we invest in entrepreneurs, the founder, the entrepreneur, and you know, your example of Xing, you know, I mean, Xing was on our podcast. He was one of the early guys on our podcast, and he has a phenomenal story, and he's obviously a very, very smart, bright guy. But you can tell within, you know, 30 minutes of talking to him, the type of entrepreneur he is, and he's definitely the type that you want to place your bet on, right? So, so finally, let's move on to sort of you jumping into a startup itself. So, I find this fascinating because when you look at basically ways to create wealth, and I'm talking about real wealth, right? You know, they say that there's only three ways that you can get that. You can inherit it. You can invest, which is, you know, you compound or you earn carry off of savvy investing. Or you can build a company that, you know, so you've basically decided to do all three. And I can tell you that from, you know, I've been parts of startups before that have all sort of failed or been pivoted and stuff like that. It's much easier to be an investor than it is to be an entrepreneur and build a successful company. So with that,
I think most investors would not agree with you on that.
Yeah, you know, but most investors haven't actually been on the other side and gotten dirty, right? So I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are. But so what made you want to basically be like, you know what, I'm going to roll up the sleeves, I want to build my own company? Maybe you can talk to us a little bit about what led you down this path, and you can explain what Zitor is.
So basically, I co-founded Zitor with my two co-founders, Danny, who's the CEO, and Jack, who's the COO of the company. It's funny, so I met Danny back in 2010, and then we just clicked. You know, we met going on a delegation to Yunnan back in 2010, and then we shared the same room. You know, government, you know, arrangement,
right?
And basically we just clicked, and ever since then we would, you know, brainstorm about ideas and all that. So Danny used to run his own software company. So he started the company even before he graduated from college. And he's been doing, you know, projects for you know, banks, for government, different government entities and all that, big projects. And I saw something very different in him, mm-hmm. right? To my understanding, you know, Hong Kong's IT sector, you know, most people are still stuck in the, you know, era of, you know, outsourcing, mm-hmm. SI projects, right? And looking at him, knowing him, he's very different. But the problem is, I think it's a typical Hong Kong problem, right? Most, you know, A grade students would never choose computer science,
right,
if they go to college in Hong Kong, right?
Right.
You know, just neglecting, you know, the ones that study in the States, mm-hmm. or UK or
sure.
Australia. And that's why the ecosystem has been not there, right? In terms of tech sector in Hong Kong. You know, all the A-grade students would go to banking,
right.
Real estate, sure. You know, even insurance, mm-hmm. You know, actuary, you know, all those majors. And I think that's why Hong Kong people in general, in my point of view, is still stuck in the era of, you know, our most glorious days, you know, back in the 80s, 90s, you know, even 2000s. And most successful people are from real estate and finance.
Right.
In Hong Kong. And there's one phrase that I still remember. I forgot who made that comment, was that, you know, right now everywhere in the world, including mainland China, you know, the younger kids, teenagers, you know, they have someone new to look up to, right?
Yes.
You know, be it, you know, Pony Ma, Jack Ma from China, or, you know, Jeff Bezos, mm-hmm. you know, or Elon Musk.
Sure.
Right. And Hong Kong, we're still talking about Li Ka-shing, right?
Yeah.
It hurts me, you know. Like, I'm not saying he's not, like, he's probably one of the most visionary or most influential people in the world, right? In the world standards. But I just think, you know, Hong Kong needs a lot of these, you know, new energy, right? And, you know, Hong Kong being a market which is very well developed, you know, be it in terms of retail, real estate, mm-hmm. everything. Few conglomerates dominate, you know, the market.
Right.
You know, it's like when you talk about startups, startups are meant to solve a specific problem.
Right.
Right. But Hong Kong is already very, in my point of view, there aren't that many problems to solve.
Right? It's a pretty efficient society here that we live in.
I mean, people talk about, you know, you know, everywhere, you know, mainland China, it's the people talk about, you know, mobile payments mm-hmm. being very mature and growing very fast. And Hong Kong, you know, we're still stuck using Octopus card.
Right.
Right. But I don't see that as, you know, a bad factor, right? Like, Octopus card, like, why mobile payments are still developing and still not, you know, up there. You know, people tend to want to blame that, oh, Hong Kong, you know, people are very old fashioned and we are so outdated, you know, we are so far behind. But the fact is, Octopus cards is very strong and influential.
Yeah, yeah.
And
they were a pioneer, front runner.
That's why there's no space or room for mobile payments to flourish, right? Because it's, you know, as a matter of fact, you know, and because Hong Kong is a very densely populated city. I'm not sure if I'm correct, but I heard from someone that, you know, for such a highly dense city, you know, when you go to 7-Eleven, it's actually much quicker to use Octopus card than and because, you know, NFC, you know, sometimes the connection is bad, and because multiple, you know, people and multiple shops are you know, connecting at the same time, then, you know, they're problems. But Octopus cards, they don't have such problems.
Yeah, right? I agree. You know, it'd be interesting to, Clarence, would be if we could figure out what the Octopus card penetration in Hong Kong is. I mean, I imagine it's extremely high, but you're right. I mean, I've never, you know, even Wi-Fi Pay, there's a lag. You have to wait and then, you know, like, but Octopus card is instant. You never have an issue.
Yep. So back to Denny. So I was, you know, I was starting to invest in startups in 2014, and end of 2014, you know, throughout those 4 years that we knew each other, we would always, you know, meet at my place and we would brainstorm different ideas. But back then, you know, because it's such a burden for him, because he had to at the same time maintain his software company. So every ideas that we talked about, it would only be a part-time thing, you know, trial for him. As you know, being an entrepreneur, you know, doing just testing different ideas at the same time managing, you know, such a, you know, heavy operational
right.
Business is very hard. So never had any success. Mm. So end of 2014, one night he was at my home and we were chatting, and suddenly he said, "Clarence, I'm actually gonna give up my company, software company." And yeah, it came to me as a shock, right? He said, "Yeah, I've never taken any days off, any holidays, so I'm just gonna, you know, give up this company, and take 2 months off, right, to clear my mind,
right,
and think about what I should do." And he said because he thought it was Hong Kong was at a tipping point in terms of B2C business. And he would hate himself for not trying.
Right.
So after 2 months, came to me and said, you know, have you ever heard of this company called Redmart? Right? And then I was like, yeah. And then he's like, so back then Redmart was still going strong, sure. And, you know, raising a lot of funding,
yeah, yeah.
And everything. He's like, you know, Singapore is similar to Hong Kong, mm-hmm. and Hong Kong is a bigger market, you know, comparing to Singapore. And he thought, you know, and rental in Hong Kong is very, very expensive,
right.
comparing to Singapore. And he saw there's room to do such thing,
mm-hmm.
Because no one's doing e-commerce.
Right.
I mean, Park & Shop has been doing for 20 years, but
their website's horrible, by the way. I've tried to order stuff off there. It's so bad.
I didn't say that.
I said it. If you're listening, Park & Shop, you need to upgrade your website.
So originally, he had that idea. And then the more research he did, the more he thought, you know, as an IT guy, there was no way that he could start an FMCG business,
mm-hmm.
right? A lot of investors actually were quite shocked that we chose online supermarket as an entry point,
right.
rather than, you know, doing electronics or, you know, fashion or, you know, all these with much higher margins.
Sure,
right.
But
then, you know, we thought there was, if we wanted to change the customer behavior, we had to pick something that affects, you know, Hong Kong people's daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
If we had started with electronics first, yes, we might be making money, right? We might be profitable by now. But then the repeat purchase is, you know, at least 5-6 months, right? So people, you know, in terms of the sales funnel, you know, probably a lot of drop offs, mm-hmm. or whatever. And then originally, so basically, he knew he had to find a partner with FMCG experience.
Right.
So he identified Jack, who was a COO. So Jack and Danny went to secondary school together. And Jack, you know, worked at Park & Shop. And then B&Q, he set up B&Q in Hong Kong. And then went to San Miguel and Carlsberg.
Right.
So he was a high flyer. You know, back in Carlsberg, he was already on management level, right?
Wow, okay.
And Jack, you know, to be honest, he working a corporate job was very relaxing for him, right? He was able, you know, to spend a lot of time with his wife and kid and earning quite decent, mm-hmm. salary.
Sure.
And one day, so he started doing research with Danny. And then one day, like, Danny never dared to ask him to quit his job,
sure,
and come, yeah. out, because, you know, typical Hong Kong person,
mm-hmm.
would never give up such a great job and, you know, come out and start their own stuff knowing it's going to be tough as hell.
Yeah, startup life, right?
Especially Hong Kong people, right? General perception. And then one day, without Danny asking, Jack said, you know, if you're serious, I'm going to quit my job and do this with you.
Wow. That's a sign.
And then the two of them came to me again. Basically, in the first place, they wanted me to involve just as an investor,
mm-hmm.
right? So they wanted me to invest in them. But then I felt, back in 2015, it was still, the startup ecosystem is still not there. You know, there's not as many accelerators, investors, yeah, and all that. And I felt it would be quite tough, especially most Hong Kong people think there's no startups that can go up against the conglomerates in Hong Kong.
Sure.
Right. It's not that we want to go up against them. It's just, I just felt, general perception of Hong Kong people with money, if you're just going to them to ask for money, with a PowerPoint, there's no way that, anyone would invest.
Yeah, of course.
Right. So they would never be a start. And I knew, a lot of Hong Kong entrepreneurs actually lack someone like me. I'm not saying I'm better than a lot of people. I'm just saying, with the kind of background and network that I have, that I possess, which a lot of people in finance, in Hong Kong also possess that. Mm-hmm. It's just as it's too much opportunity cost for these people to come out.
That's right.
And really basically join these startups to help them, to mm-hmm. assist them. So it actually took me 2 months to convince Jack and Danny that they needed me. we agreed and basically we started fundraising, and we were able to raise $1.3 million US dollars before we formed the company.
Oh wow, okay. Right?
So so yeah, great start.
So that was like a friends and family round.
Yeah, without my family actually. Right. So we never wanted to involve our family, my family. First of all, it's risky, right? And I never really wanted to affect my co-founder's judgment in terms of growing this business,
right?
Because knowing that they would be emotionally, it would affect the judgment having sure. my family involved.
Yes.
But then my family invested in our Series A. But by then it was already
proof of concepts.
Pretty, proof of concepts and everything, and we were growing pretty rapidly, and my family followed Series B as well, having a different lead. So that's different. But from the start, I never wanted to.
No, I think that was smart of you to do it that way.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of things that those early days are very crucial, especially when a founding team come together like that. And like you said, emotionally, everyone needs to be on the same level, even and not disadvantaged, because then you can actually all put in the same amount of effort and work to grow this from the ground up. I've seen it happen. Look, every business partnership that has failed that I've been involved in, it's always a case of one business partner always thinking the other one is not pulling their weight and vice versa, right?
Yeah.
So and that comes in many different ways. Some people think that they can just write a check and they think that okay, I've contributed, right? So it's good that you did that. I think that's smart. So why don't you walk us through just the basics of what the company is, and what's the user experience like? Why is it potentially disrupting this space in Hong Kong, or just creating this space?
we're not trying to disrupt anything.
Creating, because theirs is really non-existent.
but in the process, there would be, the result would be disruption, right? We never intended to disrupt anyone, any companies. From the start, it's we started off as an online supermarket, but with an angle, because especially Jack, when he was in the FMCG industry, business, he saw a lot of great quality products that didn't get enough exposure to the market. And it was very hard for these brands, branded products to list on any major supermarket chains. So in the first place, like right from the start, we knew we wanted to create a platform, obviously with mass products, big brands, and also smaller brands. So we started off only 300 SKUs, mainly supporting Hong Kong local traditional brands.
Right.
You know, when you ask people now, yeah, you know, people think, you know, we're doing such a great thing, you know, supporting, you know, trying to revive these traditional brands and, and helping them a lot.
Yeah.
But the fact is, in the beginning, they never wanted to work with us. You know, it actually took a lot of passion, time. You know, some brands took us a year to convince them, you know, you should try e-commerce, right? And especially, you know, before we started, you know, people didn't know anything much about e-commerce. Mm-hmm. They just thought, you know, online shops, you know, why, you know, I don't want you to damage my brand,
right?
So it was a tough journey in the beginning. And also the big brands, we couldn't even get, you know, products from them.
Right.
Because everybody was scared.
Sure.
Because of the big guys.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, in the beginning it was a very, you know, the can-do mentality had to be there, right?
Right.
Like we had to think of creative ways to even, you know, stocking up by buying from Park and Shop. Right. We had to start that. You know,
yeah.
One of the rice brands, they were scared and they actually said, why don't you go buy at Park and Shop? Because
fill your inventory
and we
way,
actually
right?
did that.
Wow. That's incredible.
We, basically we were selling at the same price as we bought it from Park and Shop. So we were actually burning a lot of money. In the beginning, you know, per order, home delivery,
mm-hmm.
not including the warehouse operation costs, just the delivery cost to home was 100 Hong Kong dollar per order.
Wow.
Right. If you think about that, you know, because we didn't have the volume, mm-hmm. right? We had to start somewhere. And we were lucky enough to find someone that was willing to do that, because most people would turn us down.
Yeah, of course.
And yeah, so we were burning a lot of money in the beginning. And then after a few months, we thought to ourselves, we're chatting amongst ourselves, and we're like, should we still do this business, right? So we always have doubts, you know,
of
over
course.
The past 3 years.
That's part of being an entrepreneur.
Right? Yeah. And it was, you know, before we started, everyone was like, yeah, mission impossible, blah, blah, blah. And when we were doing fundraising for our first round, you know, all my friends, you know, our friends, they were like, oh, so how much would you want us to invest, you know, each of them? So we actually had 20-something investors in the first round. And then we were like, yeah, just 50 to 100,000 US would do, right?
Yeah.
Because we think it's risky. Like, even though, you know, some of them wanted to invest more, it was like, no.
Yeah.
Don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Definitely.
So it was funny. And basically, quickly, like, I think because of our angle in the beginning, supporting Hong Kong local,
mm-hmm.
Really helped us a lot. You know, we've got, you know, like within the first year, we already got more than 50, you know, free media coverage.
Right.
Because we support, you know, Hong Kong local businesses.
Yeah, that's great.
Helping them. Because let's be real, like, you know, there's a lot of traditional brands in Hong Kong. They have a lot of fans, right? A lot of people have heard of these brands.
Right.
But they only have one shop, probably in somewhere in New Territories,
right.
Or somewhere in Kwun Tong, right? And you know, Hong Kong people, you know, most people are very busy and at the same time lazy to, you know, travel. Like,
sure.
Even the people in Hong Kong Island, they think it's too far to travel, yeah, to Kowloon, right?
That's right, yeah.
And so we feel that, you know, it's we're actually helping both sides, you know. On one hand, because of that emotional
mm-hmm.
Effect, where, you know, when we talk to these traditional brands, we never talked about money. Like, we never talked about how much money I'm going to help you make,
right?
It's all about us, you know, appreciating what they're doing.
That's right, right? Yeah.
And because of that connection, they loved us. I mean, they still love us. And in the beginning, a lot of these traditional brands, they actually helped us a lot. You know, in the shops, they would hand out our flyers.
Wow.
And telling all these people, oh, you don't have to come to our shop, you know, all the way.
That's,
you know,
great.
From Hong Kong Island to Kwun Tong to buy stuff anymore. You know, this platform, you know, they do home delivery, mm-hmm. right? So that also helped us a lot, and media coverage also helped us a lot. We were actually very surprised with our growth, you know, just in the first year. But you know, we knew that the biggest thing we had to solve was, you know, warehouse operation and also deliveries, logistics, basically. Right. And then. At that time, you know, I knew we had to find someone to help us with that, and we were lucky enough to be able to get in touch with SF Express. And originally, we were just talking about partnerships to help us with the home delivery and warehouse operations. And then they ended up investing in our second round.
Wow!
Right,
fantastic.
And with SF Express, it helped us tremendously because of the name.
Yeah, sure.
Even the big brands, you know, the suppliers, the big suppliers, they knew, you know, we had some kind of connection with SF Express. They were much more.
It's like instant credibility.
Confident,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that helped us, you know, perpetuate the growth after the second round of fundraising. And then basically through that, you know, fast track to what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
People always ask us why we are focusing on Hong Kong market instead of, you know, expanding, you know, to other markets geographically. To be much more attractive to investors, right? But the three of us, we knew is that because it's the stuff we've been building over the past 3 years, including the logistics ecosystem and warehouse operation, we're confident that if we're not able to be successful in our home market, there's no way.
Right.
We're gonna
expand globally.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean it's very different from, say, companies like Lalamove, because they're very laser beam focused on a specific problem that they're solving. And it's very asset light, right? But I would say the biggest thing is we chose to do such an asset heavy business model. And because we saw the opportunity is that Hong Kong, in terms of retail, most talent in retail, because traditional retail has been very strong, and we've been developing traditional physical retail, you know, for the past 40, 50 mm-hmm. years, right? So we were one of the first in the world, and everything is very mature, and because all the talent's going into retail. They're trained, their DNA, they are trained to be traditional retail experts. And if you ask me, there's no e-commerce or new retail experts in Hong Kong. And we are one of the pioneers in Hong Kong, obviously alongside the HKTV Mall.
Right, yeah, yeah, sure.
And we feel that who are we to go in, say, mainland China or Southeast Asia and say we're going to, you know, beat the local competitors, right? But in terms of Hong Kong, same goes to, you know, other big players in the region. Hong Kong is a very unique market. Every district has different culture. In a point of view, building a true ecosystem, we like to call it the super app of Hong Kong. Online grocery is just our starting point, but we've been expanding to other verticals as well. And we are not a marketplace. We are really, so we're more like the JD model
mm-hmm.
rather than Taobao.
Right.
Right. HKTV Mall is more like Taobao.
That's right. Right. Yes.
So we are able to control, basically the culture and our, we take a more aggressive, approach in terms of what we want to push. Rather than just providing a platform for anyone to come on, right?
Yeah, so for the audience listening in, the marketplace is basically individual vendors can set up their online shop and sell on your platform versus something like Zitor, where you curate specifically what you want on the platform. You control everything.
So we like to say we are a e-commerce company with a character,
right?
Right. we don't intend to please everyone in mm-hmm. the market. But people that like us or love us, the customers are very sticky.
Sticky, right.
And we are aiming at, you know, creating this more asset heavy, more heavy, heavier business model to basically serve different Hong Kong customers' needs, right? So our vision is to serve Hong Kong customers, but not only limited to when they are in Hong Kong only.
Ah.
Right? So we just launched a new business model called NeiBuy. NeiBuy is a community collective buy model.
Oh, okay.
So it's more like, I like to call it group buying 2.0.
Okay.
So we work with different local retailers, mm-hmm. mom and pop. And basically our aim is to help them, assist them earn more money than what they're doing right now.
Right.
Right. And basically driving traffic to these stores. So in just 3 months, we already have more than 50 shops that are working with us.
Wow.
All over Hong Kong. And this is just our first step to the new super app that we're gonna be doing.
So could the actual end consumers could be located anywhere in the world to be part of this this group buy, or is it?
It's just Hong Kong.
Just Hong Kong right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's a much more asset light model.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. We don't know whether we will use this model to expand geographically to other markets. But at right now, in our roadmap, in the next 2-3 years, we're gonna keep on focusing on basically enhancing whatever we're doing, and also providing more products and services for our customers in Hong Kong.
I think that's smart. It's smart that you are doubling down, tripling down, and focusing on nailing your home right, as opposed to just focusing on growth, which is it's a fine line.
Well, there's pros and cons.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Right? So we don't intend to attract, you know, the majority of the investors.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, doing a you know, much more asset light model and expanding to other markets quickly to show, you know, growth and potential ceiling of the business gives investors a much bigger you know, imagination, right? You know, by default, we chose a smaller market to cut the investors' point of view. Small population,
mm-hmm.
but you know, we feel that yes, we chose a much smaller market comparing to mainland China or Southeast Asia. But I mean, mainland China, like any country is comparing to mainland China is small, right? and we feel that building a brand that's local Hong Kong gives us the credibility. For let's say down the road, you know, 5 to 10 years, if we decide to move into mainland China or Southeast Asia, we feel that it's meaningful, right? But at the same time, we as a startup, we have to be focused, you know, and achieve different milestones,
right.
In the process. We feel that whatever we're doing right now, focusing on Hong Kong, gives us a very strong. What do you call that?
Like a following, like a tribe? Is that what you're trying to say? Like
that too, but also any players wanting to come into the Hong Kong market would have a hard time.
I see. Okay.
Hong Kong is a unique market in the sense that when you look at JobsDB, when you look at OpenRise, when you look at, you know, all these different businesses. I mean, they're not top notch, you know, in terms of service level or UI or UX, yeah. You know, right. Whatever. But when you think about it, all these big guys from overseas, you know, coming into the market, like Monsters, you know, like Eatigo,
yeah.
Yelp,
right,
coming in. It's not like they're not great companies.
Probably better. Yeah. Their user experience is probably better. Yeah. It's just that Hong Kong people are very loyal to what they know, right?
Because we feel, you know, the switching cost of Hong Kong customers is very high,
mm, yeah.
Right? And and the loyalty is there.
Yeah,
so absolutely. It's not like, oh, you know, so, you know, the strategies that the mainland Chinese companies that have been doing in the past 5-7 years, in my point of view, would never be sustainable in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Because mainland Chinese, well, in the mainland, you know, there's 1.3 billion people, right? For a fact, you can laser beam focus on growth, right? And don't care about job offs,
right?
But Hong Kong, we only have 7.8 million.
So you got to get it right from the start. Yes.
So it's really a different DNA.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not about just, oh, giving deep discounts, undercutting your competitors.
Right.
There's a lot more to it, right, in Hong Kong. The failure, you can't afford to fail too many times.
Right.
Because if a customer leaves you, it's going to cost you a lot more to acquire that customer back, right?
Higher user acquisition costs, a greater lifetime value. Yeah, these are all very nuanced things about the Hong Kong market that a lot of people don't know.
Yep.
And that's why a lot of, like you said, a lot of startups come and fail. Clarence, it's been great. I mean, you've thank you for your time and for sharing your experiences and telling us about your company. As we look to wrap up, I just have a couple final questions. First of all, and I didn't get to this at the beginning, but the name Zitor, please tell us how you came up with the name for your company.
So we came up with the name in Chinese first, Zitor. So Zitor actually is a very Hong Kong name, a term, because we, you know, Hong Kong, as you know, we were governed by, you know, the British for more than 100 years. And a lot of our terms are unique to Hong Kong people because they were directly derived from English. So Zitor was directly derived from store. So it's the basically representing, you know, mom and pop stores and all that. And we felt that we, from the beginning, we wanted to focus on Hong Kong. So we decided to come up with a name that, you know, people in Hong Kong could relate to.
So a little helpful tip for anyone listening in that wants to ever connect or do business with Clarence, do not call it Z Store. You will not get a response from him. That's one of his pet peeves. It's an easy mistake to make because the iPhone corrects it automatically. But yes, please know that this is a very important point. just a final couple questions, Clarence. The second to last question, and I like to ask most of my show guests this, and this one's, you can answer it in many different ways because you come from a very diverse background. You're an investor, you're an entrepreneur. You know, if you had a piece of advice for, let's say, a Hong Kong entrepreneur, you know, and I have a soft spot for Hong Kong. I'm not actually originally from Hong Kong. I've just lived here for many, many years. And so I always like to see Hong Kong entrepreneurs do well. So if you had one piece of advice based on your experience in the last few years working with your startup, what would that be?
I would say see more of the world, be it mainland China or Southeast Asia or even US, Europe. Get as much exposure as possible. And also through that, you know, try to connect with, you know, successful entrepreneurs, you know, outside of Hong Kong. Because in my point of view, in the new business or new economy era that we're going through in Hong Kong, we are lack of mentorship in the local market.
Mm-hmm.
For example, us, you know, we knew right from the beginning, we knew no, you know, Chinese VCs would be interested in investing in us. But over the past 3 years, we still, you know, travel to mainland China, Southeast Asia, you know, Europe, US, to keep on talking to these people and getting their advice.
Mm-hmm.
And also successful entrepreneurs. You know, quite a few of our mentors, you know, they were successful e-commerce entrepreneurs.
Right.
We felt that there was no one, since the beginning, there was no one in Hong Kong that could advise us what to do.
Right.
You know, yeah, when it comes to e-commerce. But also, as an investor, I would suggest not only focusing on Hong Kong. That's very contradicting to what I said.
I love it.
But I think it's, you know, by default, we chose this business. That's why we believe in focusing on Hong Kong would give us a much better outcome or result down the road. Mm-hmm. And we are, I would say we're just lucky that we were able to find investors that believe in us,
right.
Believe in what we're trying to do, and believe in we should just focus on Hong Kong. And you know, for other startups, I'm not sure, you know, in what kind of industries that they're targeting, but just focusing on Hong Kong on a specific vertical would be too small. Mm-hmm. The reason we are focusing on Hong Kong is that we are expanding, you know, horizontally, you know, to other products and services. And Hong Kong retail market is, you know, $50 billion a year. And that's not a small market.
Right.
And e-commerce, you know, online sales, you know, market share is only less than 4%, 3%. And we feel that there's a lot more room for growth. If you look at, you know, neighboring markets like Taiwan, Singapore, you know, Taiwan is almost 20%, right? And Taiwan market, you could have more than, you know, 2-3 major players that are, you know, over $1 billion valuation, market cap. So we believe in, we are one of the pioneers in Hong Kong. But that's just our business, the right. Nature of our business. But for other startups, you know, including SaaS model, including
so basically, don't try to fintech. Do what you did. Don't try to go after the impossible.
Yeah, and I mean, Hong Kong is a great starting place. I'm not talking about, you know, the support from government or whatever. You know, it's like, in my point of view, a startup, you know, an entrepreneur should never purely rely on government support.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
We've never gotten any support from the government. We never asked for them, mm-hmm. right? But it's the urge of learning, and basically the can-do mentality. Mm-hmm. If you have that, you know, be it in Hong Kong, be it in Beijing, or you know, Singapore, or whatever, you do something great, right?
Fantastic. Thank you for the advice. The last question is just, where can people find you, you know, follow you or learn more about your company, you know, or maybe if they're someone that wants to connect and potentially ask for an investment, how can they reach out to you?
That's going to be rare, approaching us to invest in us. But yeah, my LinkedIn, you know, just search Clarence Lang, Facebook also, then you probably, I'm pretty outspoken in terms of updating what's going on with our business. Right. Yeah, well, I like meeting people. That's
great.
Kind of my forte.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks again, Clarence.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed hearing your story and thanks for sharing your journey. And we're looking forward to following Zitor and hearing about how you grow the business. And I'm confident that you guys will be successful. So best of luck.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Thank
take
you.
Care.
Take care.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. All the show notes and links can be found over at jkimshow.com. Come back often and make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. Don't forget to join us next week for another exciting episode of The J. Kim Show. I'd love to hear your comments. You can find me on Twitter at jkimmer, jaykimmer. See you guys next week. This podcast is brought to you by Hack Your Fitness, the high achiever's guide to getting ripped in under 3 hours a week. If you're anything like me, you're probably working a full-time job or jobs and trying to find time to balance family life, social life, and last but not least, fitness. Look, I get it. I'm a full-time investor and entrepreneur myself, and father of two. So how am I able to stay fit year-round without spending hours and hours in the gym killing myself on the cardio machine? After struggling for the last 15 years, trying every workout and diet under the sun, I finally designed a system that allows me to achieve and maintain single-digit body fat for life in under 3 hours a week. Cardio not required. Head on over to hackyour.fitness and download my free 13-page guide that teaches you the simple science behind efficient fitness and smart nutrition and gives you everything you need to know to finally take control of your life. That's hackyour.fitness.